Hi, everyone. Thanks, Jenny. I'd like to thank Pierre for the invitation, and thanks to the Artists Institute. So if I've been invited to talk, it's because I think there's few common points between my research and Pierre's work, or rather certain common obsessions. Even if you work in quite different directions, there are few shared motifs of obsessions. So what really drives my research is the historical constitution of what I like to call the implicit script of the medium of exhibition. And tonight I'm going to try to grasp a few of them in light of the economy of two boundary practices that defined the modern cosmography and worldview. And those two boundary practices are, on the one hand, navigation, and on the other hand, vivisection. So I'm just going to share a bunch of notes with you, and my aim would be to try to inscribe the semiotic and epistemic mechanisms of the modern model of exhibition, that is the museum, in a broader anthropological model of modernity. Especially in its specific economy of the limit and its characteristic relation to the question of the border. Because when one pays attention, I think, to the modern economy of the limit, in a broad sense, one can start to understand that similar mechanisms might be at stake in different manifestations of the border, in concrete geographies, and in more abstract geographies, from the navigational techniques that allowed for the acquisition of territories and the process of, let's say, globe construction, in which consisted the modern colonial project, to the modern laboratories underpinning the project of experimental sciences. So my idea here is to inscribe the modern museum in a frontier geography of modernity, simply by recognizing first the border or the frontier as an intense producer of imaginary and of figures that are generally what we could call multi-stable figures or reversible images. Those are terms that come from the psychology of perception, that are the kind of images where the figure ground relation is unstable, where you can't say, you wonder if you see a rabbit or a duck, for example, or profile or vase. These kind of dialectical images where figure and ground is unsure or unsteady. That kind of force a choice on the viewer, and that are both the expression of, that both cleave and connect. That are images that are simultaneously symptom of a separation, of a limit, and a sort of access to a negativity, another realm that is absent, so much that the border in these images become a sort of screen of projections of many phantasms, kind of a nervous membrane. And if I'm so interested in those images is that I think that among these multi-stable figures that populate the modern frontier geography, well, art is one of them. So that's a Spanish map made of America, made in the middle of the 16th century. Because the question of the border intuitively comes to mind as defining the logic of the project to which, in my eyes, it belongs, that is, an imperialist project. An imperialist project that has been historically carried by colonial modernity. And by simplifying a bit, the way we can model these borders from, let's say, the age of discoveries, is by arguing that modernity at large has developed through a certain geometry whose role was to produce worldviews and to project them, these worldviews, on the uncharted, constructing the image of the globe, world, the Earth in general, as a system of localization of points in an homogeneous space, an arbitrarily divisible representational space. And of course, the discovery of Americas that triggered the beginning of the imperial project of colonial modernity produced a kind of westward turn in European imaginary that induced the geometrization, in a way, of European behavior in this globalized locational space. That was the big disorientation in Renaissance minds, disorientation very literally being the loss of the Orient as the polarity of orientation, basically. So in terms of chronology, this master narrative geared toward the West of colonial modernity starts with the early European settlements in America and the 16th century transatlantic seafarers, for whom the frontier was essentially any part of the forested interior of the continent lying beyond the fringe of existing settlements. And the story of expansion of the colonial frontier, we could say it ends in the 1960s with what the French philosopher Jean-François Lyotard has called the Pacific Wall. That is the moment when the frontier reaches its geographic limit, that is the Pacific coast, on the West Coast in America, in a last export of Western modernity's imperial center, and where the westward expansive gaze of colonial modernity is somehow subjected to an inward turn, like a reversal of the lens, of the optical line that was driving colonial modernity with Californian ideology and counterculture. That is from exterior expansion to inner intensification, notably with psychedelia and cybernetics, positing the subject between simply lysergic acid and silicon chip as the last territory to be conquered, in a way. And there's a very beautiful book by historian Walter Mignolo called The Darker Side of Renaissance on the particular logic, the specific semiotics, and the dynamic of the colonial frontier. It talks about colonization in terms of performances of colonization and geometric projections, notably in the first encounters of European conquerors and ethnic tribes of Central and South America. And basically what he says is that this performance of colonization is operated by the geometric rationalization of a space that, as a consequence and in a fascinating reversal that Mignolo describes, means for the conqueror populating the borders of this rationalized space with imaginary worlds. And Mignolo's formula could be summarized like that. The more you geometrize a territory, so the more you make it your own background, in a way, the more you produce the negative figures of this geometry at its own fringes. So we can understand these imaginary worlds, the fringes of the colonial conquered world, as spaces mirroring the contradictions inherent of the modern Western world, in a way. That's the way he talks about it. And if you think of the grand narrative of colonial modernity, the border always functions as a limit that delimits and produces extraterritoriality. A motif such as the colony or the island, they figure outposts, extraterritorial spaces subjected to intense imaginary worlds that are great producers of images, but also, of course, of stereotypes. So the way we can model these extraterritorial spaces is generally by recognizing that they have precisely the ambivalent status of being a multistable figure. Or more precisely, the frontier to which they belong is populated by an infinity of multistable figures. I'll explain that a bit later. And so what is interesting with extraterritory, a bit like Thomas More's utopia, is that it's the spatial manifestation of an outside that consists in a series of exports. So the export means that the modern, for example, he creates a division that is maybe already symptomatic of internal contradictions and divisions. They project them on an outside, which becomes, in the process, the site where basically you dump all the discontent from the within. So it is a multi-stable figure, like a revolving door, in that it produces figures that are undiscernible from that which is about to become a modern, rationalized, and geometrized background, and where a modern anxiety is staged or put to a test in the specific scenography offered by the extraterritorial space. this drawing is has been made during a journey to America by the team of Walter Raleigh, who was a British seafarer in the middle of the 16th century, in his attempt at finding El Dorado, which I will talk about a bit later. And of course, here the figure of the primitive is a famous multistable figure. You know, it's the dialectical image of the modern process of extraction of the figure of the modern subject from the background of nature. So that the primitive is the symptomatic counterfigure of what Giorgio Agamben has called the anthropological machine, the extraction of the figure of man from the background of animality. So all these, on the way, we could see many multistable figures such as the barbarian or the primitives as modeled by the moderns as subhumans. And it is, of course, a naked figure, but first and foremost, it's a headless, decapitated figure, or a figure where head and belly or torso are undiscernible. We could think of another multistable figure of the colonial space here as the paradisic state in which all the evil divisions of modernity that haunt modernity are overcome or outstripped. So the way I think a multistable figure, such as the primitive, happens is the following. Whatever has been implicit or unknown is turned into an explicit motif, a known motif, a figure. Whatever has been background in the next move is turned into a figure. So the unknown of ethnic tribes is turned into the figure of the primitive. That's a very simple example. And so this economy of production of figures somehow entails the explication, constant explication of implicit backgrounds, which is one of the fundamental gestures of modernity. That is to systematically turn the implicit into a theme, to turn background conditions into objects of reflection. So what interests me in this economy of the imaginary of the colonial border or colonial frontier and the economy of production of figures in this age of discoveries, so in this historical hyper event of the Earth circumnavigation and quantification, is that there are methods whereby the unknown is systematically turned into the known. The unimagined, is transformed into the imagined, where previous non-images are replaced with images, where chimeras are replaced by recordings. And so I'd like to follow this example of a good manifestation of a reversible figure or multistable image is, of course, El Dorado, that existed in the mind of European seafarers from the late 1530s to approximately 100 years later, with the kind of, the force fields of a cultish religion. (Clears throat) So this is a map made by the same seafarer, British seafarer, called Walter Raleigh, that you can find in a brilliant book by Charles Nichols called The Creator in the Map. So about the attempt of this seafarer discoverer to find El Dorado in the middle of the 16th century. So basically, Sir Walter Raleigh was looking for the Golden King, the king of the Golden City, that was named by the first Spanish seafarers El Dorado, simply. And his journey has been described in his book, in the book Raleigh wrote throughout the journey called The Discovery, that was Raleigh's logbook and some travelogue in a way, in which he kept track of the journey, and that was published a few years after his return to England. So, and of course, here, as you can see, the lines, the maps produced to prepare the venture combined the use of trigonometry, logarithmic tangents, stereographic projection. But these modes of geometry met more archaic and ancient imagery, whereby the map becomes a kind of hybrid between mathematics and myth, which give them an interesting status. And here, so literally the creator in the map is the way Raleigh was projecting the image of El Dorado. It's really a projection or an export. It was simply placed kind of randomly in the blank or the empty spaces of the map, you know, in the unexplored and still imagined landscapes. And he needed to place it on the map prior to his departure in order to give to the venture its positivity, in a way. So Charles Nichols, who wrote about this journey, describes the function of this creator in the map that figures El Dorado as having the same spatial function as what he calls the axiomatic monsters, the oceanic creatures and all that were coming from the nautical mythology of medieval cartography. Creature in the map of this uncharted territory consists of points and poles of orientation projected into the unknown, in that which has not yet been turned into a figure. And so the creature here is somehow a figure in a larval state. It is a figure that has not yet been internalized, rationalized, delimited, and acquired by the very process of the colonial venture. So really, on the blank screen of this terra incognita is projected this image of the Golden City that quickly becomes a mode of orientation, a polarity and geometric axis for cartography, but also simply for the stake of the journey. And so on the right, you have a drawing made by Walter Raleigh's team of how they imagined the Golden King, so the ruler of El Dorado, that is pictured in The Discovery, the same book. And so, just to make this kind of multi-stable figure process explicit, I put it in parallel with Thomas Hobbes' Leviathan on the left. That is, you know, the canonical modern representation of the body politic, where the body of the ruler is made of an image of communitas, a series of individuals. Because if we trace the shift in multi-stable figures, where the extraterritorial space of projection of the colony is a counter-figure or inversion of Western modern politics. If El Dorado indeed is a modern reversible image, then somehow, if we speculate a bit, the Golden King becomes the inversion of the Leviathan, in a way. So I'm just wondering here if we simply if we could play at making the list, you know, the list of the series of reversals that exist between these two pictures, as there are two images of the body politic, precisely. One that is thought inside the modern republic, and the other that is thought inside the modern republic, but projected on the outside of its very republic, precisely. So maybe these two images could be, you know, turned around the axis of their division several times to reveal in each of the results what I think should be defined as the co-constitution of the two sections. The fact that the body politic gives rise to two representations whose difference is both an operation of division and the symptom of the co-constitution of their respective representations as true projections, emerging on the same ground, on the same political line. And to finish on this moment of the multistable figure, where this kind of revolving door that reveals an opposite image as co-constituted, both in the travelogue of Walter Raleigh, The Discovery, and in the book Charles Nichols dedicated to it, The Creator and the Map, there is something even more interesting, I think, as regards the economy of the limit and the geography of the frontier we are interested in here. The first Spanish explorers that discovered America called the moment when the boat reached the shore of the New World in these early expeditions, they called it entradas, entrances. And it signified the moment when, I quote, you left the margins, the settled, the known, and made your entrance into that unmapped interior where just about anything was possible. And as Peter Sloterdijk has it, on the subjective side of things, early transatlantic seafarings can be described as an informal technique precisely of ecstasy, whereby discoverers, like shamans of an undefined religion, acquired information from a significant realm beyond. And really, the entrada, this moment when you go across the limits that you posited, is, I think, the tipping point in which consists the multistable figure. It is when the reversible image revolves, when figure-ground relations are temporarily unsettled, when what was background turns into figure, so the gradual geometrization of space turning the implicit into the explicit, the unknown into the known, and when the figure of the exterior is interiorized, appropriated, turned into a new modern background via the acquisition, the practical acquisition of the territory in colonial modernity. And so, as such, the entrada, the moment when you go across the limit, when you are into this moment of tipping of the multistable figure, is kind of notice of loss. It's what could be called the deontologization of fixed edges. That is, whatever kept apart or, you know, dialectically bound figure and ground, whatever semiotics of export projected one into the other, all that is radically dissolved in this moment of entrada. And so what I think what is important here is that the boundary practice that animates colonial modernity operates through borders that are both operative and symptoms. That's why they are multistable. They are both implicit background and projected figure. And these borders consist of exports of the modern state reason, and as such, they embody or make tangible the contradictions that haunt the ontological order of the state. For example, when you think about one of the ways the moderns defined ethnic tribes as primitive or non-modern or pre-modern, it is always by accusing them of providing inanimate objects with the faculty of animation, you know, of being animists. And precisely this border that the modern erects between animist and modern is directly linked to the fascination, I think, of modernity for animation and movement enacted in the European imperial centers of modernity. To give an example, like if you think of the story of what is materialism, you need to have in mind the foundational conversation in the encyclopedia between Diderot and D'Alembert, where you know the question is simple, is what is a stone? What is the being of a stone? And the question being, of course, should it be infused with the qualities of life and therefore be thought as, you know, as a part of a greater sensitive being, the stone, or should it be thought as pure quantities and therefore potentially negate our own existence as qualitative and sensitive beings, which is a contradiction inside materialism that kind of echoes the way modernity projected this contradiction onto animists that actually believe a stone can have agency and intentionality. And it's a, I mean, it's a contradiction that has been theorized more recently by Quentin Meyersou on materialism. There is, for him, there is a distinction, kind of contradiction in modern materialism between what he calls stonified life and vivified stone. Well, but one materialism cannot be thought without the extinction of the animist on the colonial border. Those two borders inside a stone in a laboratory in the imperial centers of Europe, this limit cannot be thought if we don't model symmetrically the way this limit is projected on the fringes of the modern republic, that is, on the colonial frontier. And so the purification of, you know, a stone, well, that's the basically the multistable figures populating the colonial frontier are the product of this ontological struggle that is inside materialism already. So it is precisely modernity at large, I think, that could be tasked as a multistable figure, as a reversible image. It can be defined as, you know, in a kind of speculative symptomology by the way modernity projected negative horizons, giving to itself the face of its own positivity. It's really constant dialectics here. And so these multistable figures, part of which is this creature, both connect and cleave. They form the negative horizon of the state reason of modernity, and through them, I think that the very making of the conceptual boundaries that historically delimited the modern project of reason can come into view, really. And so we compared Hobbes' Leviathan to the projected counterfigure of the primitive society based on the... I didn't tell you that, actually. What it's really interesting is that the golden king here is figured as a simple deposit of gold powder that is, you know, collected by the individual. So power is basically materialized as a stone on the body of the ruler. So we compared Hobbes and this relation to the primitive projected image of the power of the body politic of the primitives. And of course, Hobbes is central in the way the modern world constructed its kind of cosmography and worldview. And precisely the genealogy of modern sciences is often traced back to three tracts, that of Bacon, one of Descartes, and one of Hobbes, precisely, where Descartes captured the philosophical implication of, you know, the machinic paradigm as the basis of imagination. Bacon imagined the rules of the experimental method, and Hobbes complemented them with the conception of a society based on the scientific method. That's the lesson of anatomy of Dr. Frederick Ruysch by Jan van Eyck in 1683. And there's a beautiful text by a historian of science called Shiv Visvanathan on this ID, where he develops the concept of laboratory state. And so where he develops this triad, Descartes, Bacon, Hobbes, to show how much the state, the modern state, as the source of ultimate power, is coeval all the time with science. And so to be scientific and to become, in every sense of the term, a subject and a citizen, means to be scientific. Science becomes, in early modern experimental science, the very grammar of power, in a way. And so the experimental method, so crucial to the beginnings of modern science, can be seen as a system of simply political control that incorporates a unique mode of violence that is vivisection, basically. And within such a framework, the laboratory can become a, according to Visvanathan, a political structure and the basis of a wider vision of society based on the concept of quarantine. And when you think of the modern cosmography reconstituted by taxonomy, for example, in natural history museums, you can start to understand how vivisection indeed embodies and makes tangible the very gesture of epistemological cut through which modern knowledge unfolds. And it's a gesture to which Michel Foucault dedicated several works, notably his book Birth of the Clinic and the short text that is absolutely beautiful dedicated to Georges Bataille called A Preface to Transgression. And so to make things quite simple, it's important to model the gesture of cut, separation, vivisection in Foucault's terms, I think. Because Foucault elevated the working of what he calls the clinical gesture, so that is the gesture of epistemological conviction of object, how an object can be a site of deposit of a certain factual truth. He made of this gesture, this gesture enacted in the quarantine of denaturalized spaces such as the clinic or the laboratory or the anatomy table. He elevated these kind of gestures of cut to the rank of anthropological truth, determining the configuration of what he calls modern episteme, by demonstrating how the anatomico-clinical method of auscultation of symptoms on bodies, precisely at a moment when modern politics put at its center the matter of life, biopolitics, when how it came to constitute these gestures of cut and vivisection, the implicit lattice of the modern experience of knowledge at large. And so the key to understand, I think, the space of visibilities opened by clinical gestures in general, such as vivisection, can once again be understood through the concept of reversible image and its bizarre and specific dialectics. According to Foucault, the limit imprinted in life by a clinical gesture proceeds from a twofold and paradoxical economy by which the very frame in which it is enacted, laboratory, institution, clinic, becomes a space of production, multiplication, and projection of dynamic boundaries, like an accelerator of separations, you know? So, and as Foucault suggests, the inscription, he gives the example of madness, of course, the inscription of the limits between reason and non-reason in social space consists in a gesture of caesura that lets tumble on both sides of its sharp cutting edge, entities suddenly made mute and deaf to each other, the sane and the insane, reason and non-reason, hence requiring the synthetic mediation of an institution of scientific veridiction able to make them speak again to each other, and that is the clinic. So you have this kind of paradoxical and twofold economy here in an ever-deepening instrumental continuity, the institution administers the border of which it is the product, in a way. So the epistemic model of the clinical gesture is thus essentially double in nature. On the one hand, it silences the non-reason it objectivizes by imprinting around it limits that disconnect it from the world of reason, of the moderns. And on the other hand, these limits are precisely that which assemble a new continuity between non-reason and the rationalist world of the moderns by, you know, allowing for objective truth produced on the former to resonate in the latter, in a way. And the same goes for the question of objectivity at large in science. There's been a very important book in 2007 by Peter Galison and Lauren Daston called Objectivity, and that's what they say. They define the triangle of truth, which is an expression I like, because it gives a specific geometry to implicit gestures. The triangle of truth assembled by clinical gestures of scientific modernity. So objectivity, through this triangle of truth, kind of projects limits and borders that denaturalize objects in the world. It uproots objects, and it projects them, you know, in denaturalized spaces such as laboratories, museums. So it projects limits that run through nature, indeed, but that also, and that's crucial, that also cross through the interior of the subject, through the body, through the eyes of scientific modernity that witness these limits, and that come to not run through nature only, but through modern culture, in a way. And so you have this, in Objectivity by Daston and Galison, you have this beautiful understanding of the sleight of hand of modern knowledge that can be identified in the specific way the rationalist boundaries and objective limits it imprints in the world, paradoxically, constantly naturalize themselves by multiplying at all scales of knowledge and universalizing their language, hence gradually appearing as facts, obscuring their own existence as mere instrument of epistemic appraisal. So to make it, to summarize it, the logic of the limit enacts all at once the denaturalization of the objects it examines and the naturalization of the borders it imprints between them. And I think here this image makes pretty clear how you know, these limits that run through objects and subjects, through nature and scientific community. Here it makes quite clear how subject formation and object order, modes of subjectivation and objectivizing procedures are intimately related. And I've chosen this image because it epitomizes the scenography through which the type of knowledge produced by modern science is enacted. It's it's a painting middle of the 18th century by English painter Joseph Wright of Derby, depicting an experiment made in the middle of the 17th century, roughly at the same time of Hobbes, Leviathan, and Descartes' tracts. So an experiment by the Irish physicist and chemist Robert Boyle. So here, what happens is both interesting and extremely funny, I think. Because thanks to a pneumatic machine Boyle invented, and that he called the vacuum chamber, or the air pump, he managed to prove, and that's crucial, the existence of void in the world by producing void in a sphere of glass, which had huge theological consequences. Because the existence of void pointed at the possibility of the absence of God from it. You know, God, the universal mediator of all things. So here, virtually, the God was put to death by the existence of radical discontinuity in the world, void. And that's quite interesting how Donna Haraway describes, or has called Robert Boyle, the father of chemistry and, even more important, father of the experimental way of life. Because this is a scene of reduction and isolation. What happens here, you know, when air is subtracted from the sphere of glass, is that the life-supporting atmosphere is being withdrawn from the glass sphere, and the bird here is being isolated from its milieu, basically. So in a kind of metaphor of what is objectification, it's a separation of an object from its relational milieu. The vacuum kind of materializes what is a clinical gesture. And thus, the vacuum speaks for itself, by itself, but its language is mediated by the death of the bird. And here, the scene of the painting clearly aligns scientific objectivity with death. And precisely, it's quite interesting to, you know, a quite classical way to analyze this painting, where the audience takes the form of a forum with a specific scenography of subject formation. The scientific fact comes into being through demonstration and mediation, and certain reactions are different, and Donna Haraway talks about them, I mean, how certain affects on the faces of women are precisely that which is going to be feminized and pathologized throughout modernity, and how figures of men, white men, become in their very faces, you know, spokesmen for a kind of modesty, scientific modesty. So the bird that is dying here is a parrot. And I mean, the parrot is obviously a symbol of mimesis, you know, the kind of mimesis that was, of course, banned from the modern republic, that was not allowed to be represented as real. You know, mimesis is the contrary of modern representation. Here, mimesis is seen by the moderns as mere copy, no essence, no ID. Basically. So this is the mimesis that was counter to the modern notion of representation, the mimesis as in the jungle, as in the delirious game nature plays through similitudes and resemblances with the human mind in a series of unsettling mirror effects. So here we have the parrot and the jungle. These are two, these are for the modern imagination, symbols of the media condition of the other, a condition in which signs and things are inextricably entangled and deliriously entwined, as in the symbolic forest of projections of the primitive, the animists. So what is symbolically put to death here in this painting are two media conditions, two forms of mimesis, one Christian, and the other pagan and primitive. So well that I think this image represents the extinction of the modes of mediality between subjects and its environment that the modern suppressed at the colonial frontier. This is really an image of the colonial laboratory. And this painting is, after all, a scene of the making of a double-faced figure, another reversible image, if you will. But on new ontological grounds. The making of the object, dead bird, vacuum, is at the same time the making of subjects and of a society now grounded in authority of scientific objectivity and no longer with an appeal to transcendence. The delirious mimetic agency of objects with human mind is bisected by the purity of the dialectics separating subjects and objects. And so here is a symbol and a figuration of modern knowledge, really. The chains of mediality are being reconfigured. This is why we are looking at somehow a scene of cosmological and ontological re-engineering. The dead bird testifies to the fact of the vacuum, but this testimony of non-human things must be witnessed, read, and translated. And this gives rise to the figure of the true witness, a witness with a specific non-female, white modesty. And Donna Haraway sees in the emergence of this figure and the respective social and literary technologies surrounding this kind of scene, a founding gesture of what we call modernity, basically, effecting a separation between expert knowledge and mere opinion. And since we have some time, I'd like just to quote quickly a beautiful few sentences Haraway wrote, specifying the virtue of the witness in this scenography and modern economy of the border. "This is the virtue that guarantees that the modest witness is the legitimate and authorized ventriloquist of the object world, adding nothing from his mere opinions, from his biasing embodiment. And so he is endowed with the remarkable power to establish the facts. He bears witness. He is objective. He guarantees the clarity and purity of objects. His subjectivity is his objectivity. His narratives have a magical power. They lose all trace of their history as stories, as products of partisan projects, as contestable representations, or as constructed documents in their potent capacity to define the facts. The narratives become clear mirrors, fully magical mirrors, without once appealing to the transcendental or the magical." So here, what I think Haraway is saying on Boyle is that we have a quasi-magical eclipse of the process of mediation. That is actually the rule of the modern meta-narrative that are also visible in colonial modernity. The production of a self-legitimizing representation is based on self-uprooting figures. Figures that are concealing their conditions of possibility and genealogy in the moment of their appearance. And such figures, of course, have been the object of much modern bewilderment and postmodern critique, because they are the origin of the modern form of power. So here, the new subject created exists, so to say, by virtue of the vacuum. Its paradigm is the absence of the relational milieu for which the vacuum stands. The reduction of mediation. In the vacuum, there is pure ontological inanimate thingness. The subject undergoes a transformation that cuts much of itself apart from the new principle of reality. The merely subjective becomes a shorthand for opinion, for illusions, for fancy imaginations, for fantasy. And these characteristics and faculties are being, of course, feminized and pathologized. So here in this vivisectional, clinical, early modern science landscape, the boundary practice at stake is the agency of subject formation and order of objects. Subject formation and object orders. This is where one could locate, I think, what is a boundary practice in the description of the workings of the modern objective apparatuses in which modern subjectivity unfolds, sediments, and bisects itself. So, with the description of this frontier geography from the geometric projections, from the geometric borders that animate the project of colonial modernity at the fringes of the modern territory, to the vivisectional limits that imprint epistemic frontiers in life as such in European laboratories, what I mean to say is that to understand their respective logic, one cannot be thought without the other. Because they pertain to the same scenography of modern boundary practices in which object orders and subject formations are related in the making of conceptual boundaries that have a epistemological, figurative, and political economy, and that throughout modernity have been gradually naturalized as ontological grounds. So what about art? Well, I think the historical formation of the space of art as a space of exceptionality and extraterritoriality has a lot to do with this boundary condition. It is even, I think, a privileged space to understand how this boundary condition is being constructed. And to inscribe art in this larger frontier geography, I think it's helpful to kind of diagrammatize or draw it a bit. So I'm not going to be drawing, but we need a kind of jump. That is because many authors in the field of anthropology have thought somehow this geography. And I think that Bruno Latour, French philosopher and anthropologist, made a very powerful model of modernity that actually precipitates many of the motifs I've been talking about today. So I'm going to try to, in a sequential way, go through Latour's model and kind of speculate on the inscription of art in his model. So it's what Latour called the model of the modern constitution is in 1991 book, We've Never Been Modern. So basically, according to him, in the modern world, there is a master narrative, a meta-narrative, that is a narrative endowed with a self-legitimizing function, of what the moderns did in theory, and that's a first dichotomy. So what they did in theory, that is the official narrative of modernity, is a story of purification, of isolation of objective meanings in nature, of radical discontinuity between nature and culture, between subjects and objects. That is this limit, the dichotomy. You can figure it as the contours of the vacuum chamber, the air pump, Boyle's air pump, basically. So we have a first house that Latour calls the parliament, where subjects are purified. They are entitled to speech, and so it's basically politics that allow for the formation of the historical subject. And the second house is science, where, you know, in a strange and beautiful way, it is objects that are allowed to speak. And so it's, in a quite funny way, Latour adds one detail, that is the paradoxical language of the laboratory, very much like Robert Boyle, that he calls inanimism. Only the inanimate object can speak the language of the fact. Very much like the gesture of vivisection or of the dead bird that needs to be dead in order to be the site of deposit of factual truth. And so, interestingly, in this master narrative, you know, of purification between things and persons in modernity, these are in a schizophrenic relation. The division between them produces a certain kind of schizophrenia, a certain uncertainty on signification that take the form of the question, is it actually possible to communicate across this great divide between things and persons, subjects and objects? Is there something like conditions for mediality in this schizoid realm that are really questions haunting modern knowledge? So this is the first division where subjects and objects get increasingly purified in institutions that give the right to representation, the court of law and the parliament for subjects, the laboratory or taxonomy for objects. And then there is a second dichotomy, according to Latour. That is what the moderns did in practice. That is a story of hybridization or translation, of ceaseless associations between nature and technique, of incessant combination between objective reality and subjectivity in the construction of networks of quasi-objects. And I mean, this is mainly the work of technology. If you think about the steam engine, it produces an obvious continuity between fossil energy and human habitat, for example. This is a continuity that is a hybrid. It is somehow, you know, the mess below for the moderns, the material and technological hybrids and networks that they did not allow to be represented as real because where their own official great divide posited a radical division, the first dichotomy between subjects and objects, where this shows condition of entanglement between those realms, conditions of mediation. And so this is where basically Latour stopped his diagnosis. But although this model allows one to locate these houses of purification in the modern constitution, the space it assigns to the institution of art is very symptomatic. So the site of exhibition, the museum, is defined only as a site of deposit of the remains of the modern great divides. You know, it's where are stored the values to be respected, tradition, feelings, madness, such as it becomes the counterfigure of the laboratory. And as such, the museum and the space of art in Latour's model is not liable to the dynamics of division drawn by the polarities of purification and hybridization. Ergo, ostracizing aesthetics on the side of the imaginary or mere fiction. And I think that this model somehow ought to be completed by a materialist approach of art history. An example is Jonathan Crary, for whom the process of historian Jonathan Crary, for whom the process of modernization produced an unprecedented mass of knowledge that created simultaneously hybrids, mixtures, and associations between vision and technology under the form of new disciplinary technologies of capture and control of the attention of the human subject. So produced hybrids and mixtures, assemblage, and also this process of modernization, according to Crary, created the conditions of possibility of a purification of the aesthetic fields, the constitution of a new frontier around the visual arts via a true emancipation of vision within modernist art theory and experimentation. So following Jonathan Crary here and aligning him to Latour in a way, any consistent account of modern culture must confront the ways modernism, far from being a mere reaction, redemption or transcendence of the process of scientific purification and economic rationalization, is inseparable from its operations. So in a way, aesthetics and art theory thus needs to be brought back home, defined as an immanent entity of the modern space of these rational possibilities, and intrinsically articulated to its dynamic lines of transfer between subjects and objects, and purification and hybridization. And maybe in this articulation, it becomes possible to argue that the space of art, especially the space of its exhibition, historically provided the boundary practices of the moderns with a specific scenography, and to inscribe its institution, the museum, as a house of purification in the broader anthropology of modernity that this Latourian model allows to formulate. So to finish this talk, I'd like to, with you walk through different steps how we could inscribe art in this diagram. Because it's almost a commonplace to, state that art historically constituted itself as an extraterritorial space, gradually purifying from what it is not, as if there was a magic circle gradually drawn around art throughout modernity, where everything the moderns did not allow to be represented as real could be stored, in a way. Cases of mediality or ontological uncertainty, as in a testing ground. In the medium of the museum, for example, everything that was ruled out in modern times and in the division of knowledge and labor was allowed to be preserved, dinosaurs, mimesis, the unity of experience, even animism. And somehow, this exceptionality of art, the price to pay for this exceptional status, allowing representation to be mobilized ontologically, was political inconsequentiality. As if the constitution of the space of art was the product of an ontological struggle that allows certain things only if they are politically inconsequential. To be represented, but under certain conditions, as mere image, mere aesthetics, mere fiction. So I realize that it's quite abstract because it's quite difficult. It's a story that is not written. Throughout 20th century, art theory focused on the autonomy of art, either as an event to be brought forward and achieved in the Greenbergian narrative, or as a condition to be critically deconstructed in the postmodernist paradigm. But the actual story of the entry of art into a regime of exceptionality is not really written, and there is no bibliography, actually. So, for example, we could think of the way the German poet in the 18th century, Friedrich von Schiller, modeled this, actually. He talks about wholeness of experience. For him, you can imagine modernity or modernization as the increasing fragmentation of experience through the division of work regimes, so well that throughout modernity, life itself and experience is fragmented. And according to Schiller, aesthetics could be, the island, extraterritorial utopian space where this wholeness of experience could be recuperated. So making of aesthetics a space negating the division operative outside of it, basically. And it's fine. We can. If you think about this, extraterritorial space where a wholeness, unity could be recuperated, one could see some kind of inevitability at the end of this story of, the purification of aesthetics in the White Cube as a logical conclusion to this story, where, is materialized this extraterritoriality and in an architectural form, and where, in the thresholds you go through, entering the White Cube, a whole lot of implicit scripts and contracts are being written, and where the experience inside this extraterritorial space is really a matter of coding, of implicit scripts being rendered operative. So, and basically, these contracts, implicit scripts, are based on dialectical operations, really much like multistable figures or reversible images. Dialectical operations are principal negation. The space of art somehow negates divisions that are operated outside of it. So it's the space where, somehow, in a weird way, is operated the negation of wholeness, anyway. And so, when we define the space of art as the space that should have a quite central position in this diagram, so well that the lines crossing between nature and culture and purification and translation would need to pass by it, in a way, we can start to make it maybe more concrete and explicit to mess around and playing with this diagram. And start to think, for example, if you think about surrealism, in a way, after impressionism, the crescendo of the motif of primitivism in European art would be like looking from the two houses up there into the mess below. You look at the primitive from this purified space of art. That would be that. But also, you could start, I don't know if you can read really well, but you could start refining this model and apply this history of gradual purification of the extraterritorial space of art to a Greenbergian modernism, for example, because Greenberg was the one who tried to purify art, where each art form, according to Greenberg, slowly coming to purify itself from everything that it is not, with, of course, always avant-garde movements trying to contest this purification, deriving their logic as a rebellion against the circle drawn around art, you know, with the art and life should be polarized in a way. So well that in Greenbergian modernism here, you arrive at a very strange figure that is to purify a medium, which is, a medium is pure hybridity. It's a membrane of mediality between a subject and an object. A medium is nothing more than a mediated mess made of splinters and countless apparatuses, and that Greenberg wanted to purify. So you have really this very strange figure of someone in a kind of trivial and clownish way. Greenberg really tried to purify hybridity, which is, of course, what postmodern critique define as, you know, it's absurd. And precisely, so if the modernist tension can be defined as a tension toward the purification of the medium, the postmodernist would be defined as a tension toward the porosity of borders, you know, between arts, basically, where postmodern dance would not be dance on stage, but dance outside the stage, basically. Everywhere but the stage. And that's, you know, historically that's contemporary with what Jeff Wall calls the expanded field, late 60s, early 70s, where you have the collapse of the pictorial as the main vector of purification, whose story ends, but whose scripts are intact. And you arrive at, you know, installation, the installation as the non-genre, of the dissolution of borders, where you have, you know, multi-screens or whatever, and smoke and all these, you know, symptoms of a new mediality between that which has been purified throughout modernity, forms of art. And I mean, personally, my taste and my interests led me to really be interested in conceptual art. And precisely in this model, Jeff Wall is quite important because he talks about conceptual art, he talks about conceptual reduction as a reversal, a tipping point. Where conceptual art, you know, in this expanded field, where art is an anti-genre of itself, conceptual art is when the process of figuration is folded back onto language, but onto the purity of the dialectics that produce the very ontological designation art. Meaning, how much can you reduce the very process by which something can no longer be not called art? And you know, if you, the last thing we could inscribe here is institutional critique, for example. You know, as if you think about, you know, the crucial modern gesture we talked about, turning implicit structures into explicit figures, like the way modern knowledge unfolds. Where institutional critique, after this reversal of conceptual art, where there is no outside, you know, as Andrea Fraser says, there is no outside to institution. So where institution as the contour of the institution are basically the contour of the world, institutional critique had to continue the modern work of background explication to reflect the scripts written in the institutional framing as a theme, to make, you know, reflexivity its own resource, to explicate backgrounds that are the very frames of purification, that is, institution. So, it is actually at the light of this diagram that I like to think of the very practice of exhibition, in a way, as an unstable ontological testing ground where objects and subjects can mobilize each other in interesting and strange ways, engaging with their mutual figuration, where their relations can thus be explored as dynamic and historically contingent. And so the medium of exhibition, insofar as it embraced and was shaped historically by both the positive scientific or historical fact and the negativity of art and the subjectivity of the viewer really is situated between the ontological designations of modernity. It is a space and an optical device situated exclusively in the realm of mediation between clearly discerned object and subject as extreme cases of the possible breakdown in and of a dialogic situation of mediation. So well that I think the medium of exhibition, I have in mind Pierre's exhibition, the Centre Pompidou, a few months ago, that is traveling now and that will be in Los Angeles next fall. I think it was kind of an attempt. That's my reading of his exhibition, actually, the way I'm trying to model it now. Because the medium of exhibition is a possible means to trace shifting relations between or reciprocal productions of subjects and objects, forms of subjectivity and forms of objectivity, processes of subjection and subjectivation, and processes of objection and objectification. And the exhibition, because of its institutional history, I think is the privileged medium for, you know, turning the schizoid double vision of dualist modernity into a stereoscopic view on history, basically. Not as linear progress, but as the crafting of boundary-making practices and the form of mediality they yield and authorized. And, I mean, basically, this diagram is being radically shattered. It's radically blurred. But the grand narratives to which it belongs, I think, along with their implicit scripts, colonial or vivisectional, imperialist or clinical, these implicit scripts have remained somehow active in the background of history. And they need to be ungrounded, in a way. So that's how I will stop. Thanks a lot.